liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss collective bargaining rights at TSA with AFGE General Counsel David Bohr and the State of American Manufacturing with Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul. We'll also discuss FEMA's response in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy with AFGE FEMA Local 4060 President Robert Autry. But first, AFGE Council of Prison Locals Northeast Regional Vice President Phil Glover joins us. Phil, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Jason. How are you today?
Good, Phil. Now, Superstorm Sandy had a tremendous impact on thousands of residents on the East Coast, including those workers at the Bureau of Prisons in that area. Talk a little bit about the impact of that storm on the Bureau of Prisons, particularly in New York and New Jersey.
Yes, we had hundreds of staff lose power. We've had a number of staff lose homes, cars, vehicles. As the storm was coming in, of course, governors in New York and New Jersey were telling people to evacuate. In our case, you don't hear much about our staff, but we're right there in the middle of it with first responders. All the first responders that come back into these situations, our staff are there. They have to stay at those prison facilities and run them during these very difficult situations. And Hurricane Sandy, obviously, is the largest storm to hit the East Coast in a generation. So it was a very challenging time for our staff.
Phil, there were some reports coming out of the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan, as well as the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, where there was flooding, there were power outages running on generators. Tell us a little bit about those two institutions.
Yeah, the Metropolitan Correctional Center is located in Manhattan, the lower Manhattan, and it was all of course, the trains, all of the travel in and out of that facility was stopped due to the shutting down of the mass transit systems, and they ended up losing power and running the entire institution on generator power over a pretty long period of time, seven to ten days. They lost phone service, internet service, all of those kind of things went dark, which obviously makes it a big challenge for the staff to handle those things. The staff that were in the facility at the time ends up staying and having to work lengthy shifts, sleeping on site. Basically, they set up cots and had people stay and sleep there. And we still are responsible to make sure that the inmate population is not only secure but safe, and that the community stays safe. Brooklyn, the MDC Brooklyn facility, had flooding coming out of the river area down at the warehouse district. We had a number of staff watch as their cars were flooded up to about 3 or 4 feet. Those are all ruined. Staff were not able to travel in or out, and again, those staff that were on site had to stay for a couple days, work until they could get relief staff into them and get them out. And so those are some pretty significant challenges.
Phil, I think you bring up a really great point here, and it should be noted about the staff who had to stay, work the long shifts, sleep on the cots until some relief could get in there to replace them. And this is the very essence of what these correctional officers do in the Bureau of Prisons. This prison security is a 24/7 operation, and they don't operate themselves, these facilities. They need the people in there, the staff in there, to make sure that, as you said, they're operated safely and securely for the surrounding community, for themselves, for the inmates, right?
That's correct. And a lot of times I think, our congressmen and senators and the White House, I don't think they really think about these federal law enforcement officers who are out here every day doing what they're supposed to do and not really a part of the big picture on these budgets and cuts and and all of these benefit discussions that people were having about federal benefits. These people stood their ground in 9/11. They stood their ground for Hurricane Sandy, and I hope that it shows the dedication that these staff have. One of the things I didn't get into right away was we also had Ferretton, New Jersey, the prison there near Vineland, and we had Fort Dix, New Jersey, which also had significant storm disruptions, and we had a number of staff along the coastline in New Jersey that lost their power and homes, and obviously are trying to keep their lives together also.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Phil Glover, the AFGE Council of Prison Locals Northeast Regional Vice President. Phil, what's the morale of the workforce in the wake of this storm, not only having to deal with some extraordinary professional circumstances, but obviously the personal strain as well?
Well, I think it's been difficult. I've spoken to the local presidents on the ground in those facilities, and obviously they are their staff had to worry about their families. I don't think people realize that while the evacuation orders were given, there were staff on the site working, and so the families are left to pretty much fend for themselves while our staff still have to work. Some staff are trying to actually get into the facilities and leaving their families at home. So there's a lot of stress to the family, to children, to spouses, and the staff member themselves who have to choose basically to show up to work and know that they're going to end up staying there a couple days while something like this is happening to them, and then the family members who are left to kind of deal with the situation. You know, I think that's something that again, is not really thought about when we talk about these kind of things, and we talk about first responders and law enforcement personnel.
Phyllis, we've talked about on this show many times, there's an issue, a very serious issue in the Bureau of Prisons related to staffing and understaffing. Did that play a role in any of the situations in the facilities during the storm?
Well, I guess, Jason, we always believe that we should have more staff in these facilities generally over time. The GAO just did a report on this about prison staffing and overcrowding and underfunding the facilities. And I think GAO looked at the fact that we really should have another 3,500 staff currently working in federal prisons. And when a situation like this comes up, you would certainly want to have 100% staffing instead of the 90 to 92% staffing that we end up with. These are administrative facilities. The two facilities in New York are administrative facilities, and they have all different levels of inmates as far as security levels in those places. They're used to run to the courts out of MCC New York. You move the inmates back and forth to court and those kind of things in the federal courthouse. And so, yes, we certainly would have liked to have had more staff on board so that you have reliefs and you have more people available to operate when an emergency situation happens.
Phil, I saw some reports coming out of New York that the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which operates the subway systems in New York, had an issue where they were docking some of their workers who weren't able to come in during the storm, docking them their pay. And I'm just wondering how the Bureau has been interacting or treating the employees during this time, because obviously they were in New York as well and facing the similar transportation issues and whatnot.
Well, what we're seeing is it seems that staff were placed originally when they called in on either annual or sick leave for some reason. We have since requested that these staff be adjusted to administrative leave, and we are also starting to request evacuation payments for staff per the Office of Personnel Management regulations that deal with those issues. It's not been easy. There wasn't a big push ahead of time to have us take care of these people pay-wise. Again, there seemed to be a rush to we would leave them on annual leave. As is always the case, it seems like the agency is they want to discourage the use of administrative leave, and it seems like they think that the staff are going to take advantage somehow. And in a situation like this, you know, this is a once-in-a-lifetime event, I think, and we hope that the administration, who, you know, the president was in New Jersey and said he didn't want any red tape, and we are still seeing red tape at the institution and staff level trying to get administrative leave for staff, and we hope that that gets cleared as soon as possible.
Certainly hoping that a resolution can be found there, if for any reason, just because of the tremendous toll that it's taken on the workers and the commitment that they've made to the job, and their dedication not only to their work but to their community and their fellow workers.
Well, and we see going forward, if you look at what OPM says that agencies can do, you know, a lot of these staff who lost their homes, and we had at least two staff on Staten Island who lost their homes completely. We had staff lose vehicles, and we know of other staff that lost homes and lost their first floors, like all their belongings. And so, you know, we know that OPM says that agencies can pay evacuation payments and per diem and travel payments to staff and their dependents, and we're just hoping that the agency will find the will to do that for these staff who are now looking for homes and having to move and having to clean up after something this devastating occurs. So we will be continuing to push those issues with the Bureau of Prisons, and we certainly hope that the White House and members of Congress and the Senate realize that this should be happening for all federal employees that went through this.
Phil Glover, the Northeast Regional Vice President for AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Phil, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Jason. Take care.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll discuss collective bargaining rights at the Transportation Security Administration with AFGE General Counsel David Bohr.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by David Bohr, AFGE's General Counsel. David, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me.
David, workers at the Transportation Security Administration recently voted to ratify the first ever collective bargaining agreement at the agency. Talk to me a little bit about first the ratification process, but also what goes into these collective bargaining rights.
Well, it's a big day, obviously, to ratify this agreement. AFGE has been on the front line for TSA employees since the inception of the agency, and it took a long time to get here. We fought for bargaining rights. We fought for the right to belong to the union. We fought for an election. We fought for a contract. And all of that is finally culminated in the ratification of this agreement by an overwhelming 10-to-1 margin. So it's a pretty exciting day for TSA employees and also for the union itself.
You mentioned the 10-to-1 margin that the contract was ratified by the membership, by the voters at TSA. What does that say to you about the enthusiasm behind not just AFGE representing the workers, but also the right to collectively bargain now?
Sure, it's a big deal. And the turnout is also pretty extraordinary in my experience. There was almost 20,000 people voted in this thing, and that is far in excess of our membership. So clearly, all the employees in the agency had their eyes on this negotiations. They've been saying for months, you know, they were anxious to see how it came out. And when they saw it, you know, they approved it by a 10-to-1 margin. So they're very clearly impressed with the contract and the contents of it, and excited to be finally covered by a binding collective bargaining agreement.
The workers obviously have spoken, and as you mentioned, more people voted than were actually AFGE members. In your assessment, is this almost an example of democracy at its finest?
Well, it really is. In most union contract votes, it's the members who vote on it. The union negotiated the contract, and then they sent it out to their members to vote on. But here, TSA management had insisted from the beginning, and we didn't argue about this really, that everybody be allowed to vote, whether you're a union member or not. And yeah, that's a democratic sort of approach to the thing. And sure enough, thousands of folks who aren't even our members weighed in, cast their ballots, and you know, we're excited to know that by an overwhelming margin, they approved the contract.
David, of course, our listeners know that while pay is not negotiable at the federal level, there are a number of articles in this contract that significantly improve the working lives of TSOs, including things such as bidding for annual leave and shifts. Can you talk about some of those articles in the contract?
Sure. Like with a lot of newly organized groups, one of the big complaints we heard during the organizing campaign was just a lack of consistency across what is a very large and spread out agency. And so the one of the big accomplishments in any first contract is to spell out once and for all how certain procedures that you would think would be fairly simple, like bidding on your shift or bidding on your annual leave and things like that. We had a chance to spell those out now in a consistent way across the system. And that's something that means a lot to the employees. They don't like to find out that, well, we used to do it this way, and now we're going to do it this other way, and here's a memo that we're going to change the way we just did it. Now they'll have an enforceable contract that says this is how shifts are going to be bid, this is how annual leave is going to be bid, this is how you can trade your shift or take vacation. All these things are spelled out, so everybody knows where they stand.
And this clearly defines the rules going forward, right? Not just for employees to know what they have to do and when they have to do it, but also for management to understand clearly this is the boundaries within with which you will now operate.
Right. In my experience, the contract becomes the employees and the managers end up owning this contract, and they'll carry it around with them, and they'll refer to it, and it becomes a working document that helps to run the operation because it spells out things that used to either be unsaid or that used to change from time to time. Now it's spelled out so everybody knows where they stand.
You've been working on this contract and with TSA for 2 years now since your time here at AFGE. What is your sense from your counterparts on the management side about the feeling of the contract and moving forward working with AFGE?
I think it was a very positive experience. We engaged in what's called interest-based bargaining, which is a process where the parties don't just take positions. They talk to each other about what their interests are in some of these areas, and they try to work through it as a mutual problem-solving exercise. And I think management would tell you as well that they learned a lot from that exercise, hearing directly from our negotiating committee, which was made up of about a dozen TSOs from all over the country, large airports, small airports, everything in between. It helped management to better understand what it is that the TSOs are looking for, what would make for improvements in morale, what would help improve the operation, and so forth. So, yeah, I think it was a very positive experience on both sides.
David, you've been a fixture in the labor movement for quite some time. You understand how contract negotiations work. How does this negotiation process rank up there with some of the others that you've been a part of?
Yeah, I've done negotiations for about 30 years, all my career, and this was not an easy negotiation. It's a difficult process. I always refer people back to statistics that I learned early in my career, which is, when you have a union election, only 40% of the time, as a rule of thumb, only 40% of the time does the union win the election. And of those that win, only 40% of the time do they ever get a contract. And so getting to this stage where we've put all of that behind us, the organizing, the negotiations, everything is behind us, and we now have a contract, is really the exception to the rule. It's a minority of employees who start down this path ever get to the point of having a union contract. So this is a big achievement. It wasn't easy. There are a lot of twists and turns along the way. But in the end, I think both sides really stretched to come together and make this happen. I think it's all to the good.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with David Bohr, AFGE's General Counsel. David, at an agency like TSA, where workers are under tremendous pressure to keep the flying public safe, how important is it for them going forward to have these protections in the workplace?
Well, I think it's really key, and I think the management at TSA recognizes this as well. And when Administrator Pistol adopted the determination that set this process in motion, there was recognition in that document that this is a way to improve morale, improve the operation, open the lines of communications, and so forth. And so I think it's key because just on a practical level, again, the employees now have a contract that they can rely on. They know where they stand and they know how it works. And that frees them to really focus more on their work. If you were worried every day, oh, is my leave going to be granted, or what are they using for the performance evaluation measure this time or whatever, that takes a certain amount of mental focus away from the work. Now the employees will have that contract. They'll know that they can fall back on that and it's enforceable, and that will free them up, I think, to be more focused than ever on their important mission.
When you take a look at the contract and you look at the articles included, what's one thing that stands out to you that you think to yourself, hey, this is really, really good for the employees?
Well, I think the shift trade provision is a big deal, and both management and the union recognized that that was an area where there was no existing program for doing a shift trade. This is where, let's say, you are scheduled to work Monday through Friday, and I'm scheduled to work Thursday through Tuesday, and we can trade a day where it suits your needs and my needs, and there's no skin off the back of the agency. It's really a way to ease up the scheduling process. It makes management more confident that the employees are going to be there who need to be there on a given day, gives the employees more flexible. It's a real typical win-win kind of provision, and I think that's going to see a lot of accolades on both sides, management and the union, as it's rolled into effect.
What do you see next for TSOs and for the workforce now that the contract has been ratified and the workers have had their say?
Well, I think there's always a shakeout period on a new contract. This is a 70-page document that has a lot of details in it, and both sides are going to have to start to understand, all right, what does this all mean as a practical matter in the day-to-day operation? And so, you know, we'll be working with management to see that it all gets implemented properly in a timely fashion. And, you know, we'll learn together how this all works and make adjustments as we go along. But I think it's nothing but a positive step.
We talked earlier a little bit about the pressure that TSOs are under in keeping the flying public safe. Can you talk a little bit about some of those pressures and what it's like to be a TSO in today's environment?
It's tough. It is really tough and unnecessarily so, I think. And it's sad to say. You know, I was in the airline industry on 9/11, and this agency came about for a good reason, and that is that security on 9/11 wasn't up to the task of stopping the terrorists. And so this agency came into existence in a national consensus that we needed to do a better job of keeping terrorists off the airplanes. And so all of the backstabbing and all the criticism and all of the hoopla that surrounds TSA today in the popular press and some of the traveling public, to me, always rings very hollow, because this agency has an enormous, very important mission to fulfill here, and they take a lot of unnecessary criticism from people who should know better.
And then on the flip side, what are some of the rewards of being a federal employee, particularly at TSO?
Well, certainly we believed when we lobbied for the creation of this agency that a professional, federalized transportation security workforce was going to improve security, and it has done that. It's been a great success in its 10 years of life, keeping terrorists off the airplanes or interdicting terrorists or keeping contraband off the airplane. So by almost any measure, it's been a tremendous success. And we understand it's a difficult job, but it doesn't need to be made more difficult by all of the constant hyperbolic criticism that that we hear from some members of the traveling public.
And lastly, David, what has this journey been like for you as AFGE's general counsel? Of course, we mentioned you've been here now for 2 years and deeply involved in this process. What does it mean to you personally?
Well, it's an honor to me to come in just in time to have a role in the election campaign. I've been an organizer my entire career, even though I'm a lawyer. I've always done organizing in the labor movement, and this was the biggest union election in the last 50 years. So just to be a small part of that was a real honor to me. And then to help negotiate the first agreement, I felt like, again, I had 30 years of negotiations experience. Our whole committee was new to this. Management's whole committee, frankly, was new to collective bargaining. And so I felt I brought some expertise to the process that hopefully moved the ball in the right direction here. And so just to have a chance to participate in that was a real honor.
AFGE General Counsel David Borer. David, it's always fun having you on the program, and thank you for your time and, of course, your commitment to AFGE's members.
Thank you, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll look at the state of U.S. manufacturing with Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Scott Paul, the Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
Now, Scott, President Obama has indeed won a second term. What are you expecting from him regarding manufacturing in this country in that second term?
Well, I think the president focused a lot on manufacturing during the last couple of years. It was the highlight of his State of the Union address, and anyone who had their TV on saw the president talking about manufacturing during the political campaign. One of the goals he has specifically stated for the economy is to create 1 million new manufacturing jobs over the next 4 years, which would be quite an accomplishment if it could be done. It would mean slow and steady growth in manufacturing, although more than we've seen over the last couple of years, and it would get us on a path to having a growing, more vibrant manufacturing base. I do think it's possible. I think there's a lot of things we need to do on taxes, trade, workforce, innovation to make that happen. But I'm glad that he's clearly articulated a goal like that, and it's going to be a big part of his agenda moving forward.
Scott, how would those 1 million new jobs compare with what the manufacturing job status was before the recession?
Manufacturing from 2000 to 2009, lost 5.5 million jobs. That's actually one third of all manufacturing employment that disappeared from this country over that decade. It lost, obviously, it took a deep dive during the recession. But starting in 2010, and I think this is quite interesting, starting in 2010, we saw manufacturing employment rebound. And from the beginning of 2010 to today, we've seen about 500,000 manufacturing jobs added. That's good growth, not spectacular, again, but good growth. It's the most growth we've seen in manufacturing jobs since the early 1990s. And it does show, I think, that there is a possibility of growing manufacturing. Look, it's not going to look like it looked in the 50s. There's no question about that. But I think it does show that there is a possibility, if you make the right investments in this sector, that you can regrow manufacturing. And that has benefits for every other sector. It means you're going to have middle-class jobs. That means revenues are going to go up. It means people are going to be spending more at retail stores. It means the public sector will have a better budget situation. So there are a lot of benefits to the rest of the economy from a healthy and growing manufacturing sector.
Scott, I think that you're right when you say that manufacturing today isn't going to look the same way that it did in the 50s, but it's still a big part of this country and its economic, you know, survival, if you will. My question for you is, how closely linked is manufacturing in this country and those jobs that are created in manufacturing? How closely is that linked to the economic recovery that we're pursuing now?
Manufacturing and economic stability and recovery are intimately linked. Let's look at the auto sector. The auto sector was left for dead in 2008, beginning of 2009. The president made a bold decision to rescue it. It was an incredibly unpopular decision at the time. But when you look at the situation today, you see growth in the auto sector outpacing a lot of other types of economic growth, and you see GM, Ford, Chrysler, all doing very well, all increasing or holding their own market share, hiring again, moving some jobs back from overseas into the United States. Consumers have better choices. I don't know anyone who isn't happier with the choices they find from the big three in terms of the automobiles than they had, say, 5 years ago. So it's been a net benefit. And, of course, when you have folks buying automobiles, that helps the retailers. Obviously, there's some tax revenue coming in. And the other piece of this that I think that's important and why manufacturing is essential, even though the employment numbers won't approach what they were in the 50s and the 60s, is that all the smart academics now, the guys at Harvard and at MIT, are saying you can't have real innovation in this country unless you have production, unless you have manufacturing. The two are linked together. And when we lose our production, we lose our innovative edge. So that means that the next best thing will be invented somewhere else. And if we lose innovation, that means we're going to be falling behind in the tech sector and other advances as well. So having manufacturing is key, obviously, for the jobs that it does support, for the economic activity that supports in other sectors of the economy. It's obviously important in a lot of states where it's the primary driver of the economy. But last and not least, it's important to the innovation in our country and the ability to invent and to have cutting-edge technology that we are discovering here.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Scott Paul, the Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, manufacturing was a big topic on the campaign trail. Obviously, President Obama and Governor Romney debated about it, talked about manufacturing in this country. One of Governor Romney's campaign promises, had he been elected, was to crack down on China and its currency manipulation. How do you see that statement differing from what you've seen from President Obama, if at all, or perhaps they were the same?
Well, there's no doubt that China played a key role in this campaign, and you saw both President Obama and Governor Romney talk about China and mostly how their opponent had failed on China. And so Governor Romney was correct. when he said that President Obama had not named China as a currency manipulator. I have to say it's disappointing to me. It's been disappointing to others in manufacturing and to some in labor that President Obama didn't name China as a currency manipulator. He's done a lot of other stuff on China, though. He has taken trade cases on clean energy, on automobiles, on steel, and other sectors to fight for a level playing field for American workers. And the president sort of turned the table on Governor Romney and said, well, when you were Governor Romney, when you were head of Bain Capital, you all did an extraordinary amount of outsourcing to China for the factories that you bought in the United States, which, again, was also true. And so you had a candidate, Mitt Romney, who talked about China in the way that Republican candidates have not in the past. But you also have a president who, while he doesn't have a perfect record on China, he's made a lot of progress. And it's clear to me from, you know, how the election turned out, particularly, you know, in states like Ohio, that the president's argument was more persuasive to the voters.
So what ultimately do you think that we can do to level the playing field with China and crack down on that currency manipulation?
Well, there are some things that we can do. And first, I'm not in the blame China alone crowd. I do think that we have to do some things here at home. But we do have to make sure that there's a level playing field for our workers, for our businesses. And if China is cheating and not living up to its trade agreements, we need to call them on that. And I do think that President Obama has done a good job of that, and I hope that will continue. I think it will. The president, within the last year, has set up a trade enforcement office that will aggressively try to counter unfair Chinese practices. And one of the first cases they launched was in September against auto parts and auto subsidies in China that were keeping U.S. products out of the Chinese market. So that's certainly one thing that we can do. The other thing is I think the trade deficit with China is big and it's growing. It's not shrinking. That's going to put some pressure on the president to produce some results to get that down. Because, again, we're not going to be able to grow our economy very well if we have this massive trade deficit with China. So that's what I'm looking forward to with regard to China. Now, internally, I think we also need to do some things to strengthen our manufacturing sector. We need some tax policy changes to stop the incentive for outsourcing. We obviously need to invest in our workforce to make sure that we have skilled workers and that we have an opportunity for kids who want to enter manufacturing careers, whether it's on the assembly line or through scientific and engineering careers, to do so. And then also keep that government-funded research alive and kicking, because that is what helps to produce a lot of innovation, a lot of new products in the private sector.
And infrastructure investment certainly is something that would produce a lot of jobs and also update the country's infrastructure and modernize a bit, if you will.
Yeah, you bet. And I'm glad you mentioned infrastructure, because there's a benefit, obviously, to commuters, to anyone who uses our roads, our bridges, our rails. There's a benefit to our economy in efficiency. It also creates a demand when you invest in our infrastructure for construction jobs, that's employment, and for manufacturing materials. You know, those bridges are made out of steel. Those roads are made out of concrete. Those schools were made out of bricks and glass and wood and drywall and what have you. And so there's an opportunity for American manufacturers there that's going to benefit the public as a whole. So I think infrastructure investment makes a lot of sense. I do hope the Congress and the president come back to that. And I have to say, I am concerned with all this talk about austerity and sequestration, that we not lose sight of the fact that unless we make these investments that are going to produce a public good down the road and will only grow more expensive if we put them off, our economy will not grow, we'll go into recession, and we'll end up with perhaps even larger budget problems down the road, because we'll have a very unbalanced economy. So do we need to cut wasteful spending? Absolutely. We need to grow revenues. But one thing that we shouldn't do is shortchange the investment we're making in our future, and that's education, that's infrastructure, that's innovation, and obviously that's the compact that the government has made with senior citizens and people who have healthcare needs as well.
Scott Paul, the executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, it's always great fun having you on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
My pleasure, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about FEMA's role in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy with AFGE Local 4060 President Robert Autry.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Robert Autry, the president of AFGE's Federal Emergency Management Agency, Local 4060. Robert, first time on the program. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Robert, people across the East Coast have been impacted by Superstorm Sandy. Talk about the work that FEMA has done in response to this storm.
We have deployed a number of people to go out to assist the disaster survivor. We have on the ground, I think, approximately 2,300-some-odd employees. I myself have recently volunteered to put my name on the list to go out also, and I did this past Saturday. We also have other agencies, state and local partners, who are helping us in this effort to try to get people's lives back in order.
Robert, while you're an agency accountant, you have been trained to help disaster victims, and you did so, in fact, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Talk about your experiences then in 2005 and what drove you to participate in the recovery efforts.
Yes, sir. At FEMA, when you come on board, the agency has this description about employees going out on disasters. So that's one of your main functions outside of your regular duties and responsibilities. So when disaster hit during, I should say, the hurricane season time from June 1st through November 30th, we know at that time that we could be called to help out with the disasters. So in 2005, when I was called for Katrina, I was deployed on a 30-day assignment. However, my 30-day assignment turned into approximately 90 days, 3 months. And the reason for that was a lot of the disaster survivors that we were helping at that time, FEMA was sending people back home for whatever the reason, and the public took exception to that because they said, wait a minute, FEMA's leaving us here. And the agency decided to put out a memo to stop a lot of employees from coming back home. And normally your tour duty for a disaster assignment can last for approximately 45 days straight. And then they'll give you what I call a 2 week break. And as an employee, you could take that 2 week break. But during that time frame, I felt the compassion to stay the whole 90 days.
When you were dealing with the aftermath and you were stationed in Mississippi, what did you see? What were some of the sights and the sounds that you experienced while you were there?
I experienced a lot of the locals who needed housing, and there was gas shortage, and it was all kind of stuff. We had to stay at least 2 hours from our site that we had to do our normal duty work. So I had to drive back and forth 2 hours each day. My work schedule started off for approximately 16 hours, day shift. Then eventually it was brought down to 14 hours days to eventually 12 hours a day. And that was 7 days a week around the clock. The people needed food. They needed water, all the basic necessities. Some of them needed electricity. So debris moved from the housing, the property. It was a lot of stuff. So what happened, we eventually went into the different neighborhoods door by door. We talked to the different disaster survivor, got their information, and we prioritized things based upon the medical need of that particular individual. So we put that report at the top of the list. So if it was an asthmatic type patient versus someone who didn't have asthmatic problem, I wouldn't say it was put down on the lower level, but we gave more of a high priority to the person who had that medical need.
When you were going door to door, knocking on doors, offering your assistance to the victims, what kind of response did you get from them?
At the time, it was a little mixed because under the old FEMA, as I would say, since I've been there since December 79, FEMA was an independent agency by itself. But in 2003, we was under Department of Homeland Security. And when Department of Homeland Security took over, we had to go through what I've called different steps of approval before we could go out on disasters. So if we was an independent agency under the old FEMA agency, we would have went out on a disaster in day one. But up under DHS FEMA, we went out, I think, on the third day. And that delay kind of put us in a bad position with the public because they kept saying, where's FEMA? Where's FEMA? And when we got down there to the disaster site, I was stationed in, assigned to the state of Mississippi. People was kind of upset with us. So, matter of fact, on the first couple of days, we had to take off our FEMA attires and just go with our plain clothing so people wouldn't know who we was at that particular point in time because some people actually got shot at or whatever else you want to call it, out of frustration.
What did that experience have on you personally, not just the negative, but the positive and the toll that it may have taken on you personally? I know that you left your daughter behind to go and help these victims. What did the whole experience have on you?
The whole experience, you know, my mission was to complete the job. My heart and compassion went out to the people. I like helping people. When FEMA was created April 1st, 1979, by President Carter, the first thing that I did fresh out of college, I said, wait a minute, this is an agency like helping people. So that was right up my alley. So when I got to the state of Mississippi to help the residents or the disaster survivor, my experience was basically to show them that we cared. We was there to assist them, to get them the federal assistance that they needed. And as a matter of fact, I even climbed the top of a couple houses to put up the tarps and different things like that. I was putting myself at risk, but I felt that I needed to do this because this old lady, she was a widow, and she didn't have anybody around to assist. So being the type of person I am as a gentleman, I extended that on my own, not at the government expense, but at my personal expense. It was a positive relationship that we developed with a lot of people before we left.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Robert Autry, the president of AFGE's FEMA Local 4060. Robert, as you mentioned, there were some of the disaster victims who had a negative feeling about FEMA at the time and questioned the timeliness of the response. But since then, how has the agency improved? Where have you seen areas of improvement that have made the agency better?
I want to say that a lot of the red tape, the bureaucracy and different things has been cut out. We're in a proactive mode. We want to be there day one. We want to respond to the disaster survivors immediately and as quickly as possible. As a matter of fact, our 1-800 number, let me spell that out, is if you want federal assistance, is 1-800-621-3362. And what we do, we try to get people to call in, and our length of time is to try to assist the disaster victim within a 15-minute time frame. And back during the olden days under Katrina, we did not have that mechanism built into our process. So we're kind of, like I say, leaning forward, trying to do the best we can to connect with everybody.
Of particular note in this instance with Superstorm Sandy was how prepared the agency was in advance, having dispatched workers to potential sites in advance of the storm, ready to go, so that when the aftermath and the rescue and cleanup efforts were underway, people were already in place. How important was that for the agency and for the victims who needed that help?
All right, I'm glad you asked that, because what we do is up front, initially, we send out what we call our urban and search rescue team, and basically they go to the different buildings, houses, or whatever else you want to call them, and they go inside and they look for people, try to basically save their lives during this hurricane or disaster. And they will mark different buildings if the structure is not well on its foundation to stay out of it. They'll put a little X on the building. So when we, as at the time, come up behind the urban search rescue team, we come behind them as community relations specialists to go out into the different buildings and talk to the residents. The urban search rescue team does a wonderful job for the safety, not only the disaster victim, but the people who volunteered to deploy for the different disasters.
What drew you to FEMA?
What drew me to FEMA was the fact that I grew up with a core belief that my mother kind of instilled in all our family members. I have two sisters and one brother, and she said, if you see somebody that need help, help them out, don't pass them by, that type of thing. So throughout my life, I've been involved in a lot of different situations, even on the streets where I went out and broke up a, you know, some fights and different things like that, because I believe that we all should be cognizant of the fact that God put us on this earth to live as safely as possible, not to destroy it.
And do you think that some of those beliefs that your mother instilled in you as a young boy also drew you then and encouraged you to join something like the labor movement?
Yes, because once again, labor movement is about helping people. The way that I like to put this, God put special people in a special situation at the right time in special places to do his will. So as a righteous person, we want to do that which is right. If there's something wrong, let's bring it to management attention and try to get it straightened out. My motto at FEMA is that we're striving to make FEMA a better place to work. And to do that, we want to make sure that we have the compassion, the integrity, the fairness, and the respect in which to do those things. And those four words that I just mentioned is a driving force behind the core value of FEMA, too.
You mentioned that you've been with the agency since 1979. How has the agency changed over the years during your career?
It has changed. We have had nine different administrators. I would like to say the one administrator that stands out to me the most is James Lee Witt. He was the administrator for 8 years, from 1993 to 2001. And I'm digging way back in my memory bank here. And basically, James Lee Witt put FEMA on the map from a publicity standpoint. The news media, the television station, everybody knew us, okay? He brought along that emergency management professionalism. In the past, he passed that along to his managers under him. And his basic thing was, hey, let's make sure we treat everybody right, give everybody that respect. So that kind of fed into a lot of the employees coming to FEMA feeling good about it. We was a family. We roll up our sleeve and we go down into the trenches and we help each other out.
Many times when people hear about the federal government, they only think about it from a very large perspective, a 30,000-foot view, if you will. Talk about your commitment as an individual, as a singular employee to the public at large.
I like to say that, as the old saying goes, you put in an honest, hard day's work. I believe that if you get hired by somebody and you own that mission, you want to help that organization achieve its mission. And by doing so, you want to apply certain principles. And your principles should allow you to meet the agency objective. I also believe in punctuality does count. Being on time help with everything. So I think that my mother instilled in us those tremendous value of hard work, don't give up, apply your principles, and dedicate yourself to the will to achieve anything you want to accomplish in this world.
Lastly, Robert, tell me one thing about FEMA that people might not know.
Sure. I can give you a little educated point of view here. Let me break it down this way. Under the old FEMA, we used to have what I call the two R's, the P and the M. Two R's basically is response, recovery, preparedness, and mitigate. That's the core value of FEMA. In 2003, when Department of Homeland Security took us over, the agency became what I would call the two R's, the two P's and the M. If you can remember the one P that I just told you in terms of preparedness, the other P up on the Department of Homeland Security is just for protection. So under Department of Homeland Security, FEMA has response, recovery, preparedness, protection, and mitigate. And those core values that I mentioned earlier about compassion, fairness, integrity, and respect. And that's what gets us moving to do the job that we need to do.
Robert Autry, the president of AFGE's FEMA Local 4060. Robert, we appreciate your time here on the program today and your commitment to the American people. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been enjoyable, and I will continue to look out to help the disaster survivor and try to get everybody else on board, too, as a union president.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE Council of Prison Locals Northeast Regional Vice President Phil Glover, AFGE General Counsel David Bohrer, Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul, and AFGE FEMA Local 4060 President Robert Autry. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you by the